did.
I hope that none of you were misled. The meeting was scheduled to start at 9:30. But I can see that you appear to be ready and impatient and felt abused. Made to wait for too long. The time was 9:30. You are all welcome. I have the following organizations on my agenda. I just want to make sure they are all here. Community Law Center, Cape Bar Council. Is Cape Bar Council here? Or they'll be here at 10 and 12. Center for Child Law, University of Pretoria. Okay. Gender Health and Justice Research Unit, University of Cape Town. Dr. Annick Cavers. Okay. Ms. Morgan Morrison. Toy and Victim Empowerment. Women and Men Against Child Abuse. That's all. Who's that? No, that's fine. That's fine. Now let me welcome in particular the presenters and thank you for agreeing to appear for this committee. We value your participation, and that's why we had to extend the deadline for the submissions. Initially, we received about more than 400 submissions, and after the extension, we received more than 900. So we hope that you have been following the debate that we were directed by the Constitutional Court to cure certain defects in the legislation, but the instructions of the Constitutional Court seem to have been widely misunderstood as legalizing sex between adolescents or licensing adolescents to have sex at pleasure. And our understanding is that this is all about decriminalization of sex between adolescents. And we think that the question before us is simple. Whether we should use the criminal justice system to educate our children, or whether that responsibility should lie elsewhere, for instance, on the shoulders of parents, civil society, faith-based organizations, and so on and so on. And now we believe that you represent the people, you represent the affected communities, you represent children, and that your inputs will help us to respond to the questions that the Constitutional Court has put before us. So be free to express yourself. We value what you have bring to us, because without you, we would really be impoverished. And thank you and most welcome. We will allocate each of you 15 minutes, but you will have time to elaborate during question times. May I then request the Community Law Center Minister Samantha Waterhouse to address us, and you have a reserved seat. That you can face the nation. To share your 15 minutes. Okay.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members of this committee. We too are grateful for the opportunity today to present to you and appreciate the commitment that this committee has shown to public engagement as you, I think, grapple with your various representative and constitutional duties. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Mr. Lorenzo Wakefield, who is from the Centre for Justice and Crime Prevention. He will be presenting half of this submission, which I do know, based on our timing, will probably take 60 minutes, and we do hope that you'll be lenient for that 1 minute with us, please, Chair. I know. I've factored that into our timing. Our submission will be addressing both of the issues that are covered in the amendment bill. So we will not only be speaking about the decriminalisation of consenting sexual activity between adolescents, but also dealing with the issue of the automatic placement of names of children on the sex offender, on the child, sorry, the register for sex offenders. We won't be going through our written submission in detail. We trust the committee have copies of it available. And we have provided quite significant detail into the background to our arguments and where possible evidence to support those. I would like to, before we start, alert the committee to the fact that our submission, which is joint, has also been endorsed by a further 20 organizations and 5 individuals, who most of whom, 18 of whom, were not able to make individual submissions to this committee. Further, that it is informed by a workshop we held with 19 different organizations in January this year. I think what's important to note about that workshop is it wasn't simply a workshop of, if I may, elite NGOs from the academic sector. And in fact, we were quite at, went to great lengths to ensure that we had representatives at that meeting from organizations from 5 provinces, including very rural provinces, and organizations that work in extremely impoverished, either urban or rural communities, to support children and their families. I'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that the SASU Parliamentary Office submission, the written submission to this committee, refers to our submission and expresses its support of everything we have included in our submission. I'll move now to the issues at hand, and, you know, as I think many of you have seen me here, we have been witnessing the hearings over the last week. We have participated in some of the public platforms debating this issue and would concur wholeheartedly, Chairperson, with your view that the nature of the debate is often being skewed. So we are hearing that this is either about giving adolescents permission to have sex or it's about criminalising it. And in fact, that's not the point at all. Rather, as the Chair suggested, the debate centres on the question of what is the best way that we as country, as a government, I'm sorry, I'm not a member of government, but that we can come up with measures that will ensure that adolescents make healthy decisions about their sexual lives. And we tend to agree, I don't think I've met anyone yet, who believes that young people should be engaging in sex at lower ages. So this broad agreement, whether it be from very conservative religious sectors or the more so-called, as we were referred to, liberal human rights genders, that we want to create a society in which young people are making choices at later ages to engage in sexual intercourse specifically. So we, you know, from that position, we therefore support the notion of employing evidence-based or research-based solutions to the issue. So very often something that seems sensible, that if you think about it, this should be a very good idea, this will help our problem. Very often that's not the case. And when you look at big studies, they start to show us that in fact the thing that is known as a common sense solution is in fact not the right solution to the problem. And so for this reason, the Community Law Centre, Centre for Justice and Crime Prevention, and organisations that supported this submission are in full agreement with the findings of the Constitutional Court. Firstly, criminalising this behaviour in the simplest form doesn't work. There's no evidence to show that the fact that it's a crime means that young people decide not to engage in these behaviours. So we've got a tool in place that seems like a good idea because it's expressing a value that we in society hold, but in fact it doesn't do the job that it is intended to do. We also agree very much and are deeply concerned at the extent of negative trauma that that young people are exposed to once they enter the criminal justice system, and also this notion that diversion says that we 100% support the court, that it doesn't. And I've personally worked with families who have young people being questioned by police, going through the court system, being interviewed by prosecutors, and there's no doubt that that has very negative consequences on them, most notably that it breaks down the trust and the relationship between that child and the adult, which is exactly what the evidence tells us we want to be building. We also agree that the fact that it's a crime acts as a barrier not just to communication between parents and young people, but also to young people accessing services. Services that if you look at public health models, if you look at sexual and reproductive health rights experts, you see that there are specific services that are helpful again in ensuring that young people do not make decisions for which they are not emotionally, socially, or physically ready. The good news is we do know what works, and court also alludes to this, and this committee has discussed it at length. The issue of building communication between young people and adults, particularly their parents, but not necessarily only their parents. And certainly there's a role outside of the law for, be it religious structures or community structures, to facilitate that. But also I do believe government has a role to do what it can to strengthen and support families. And I'm very pleased to note that we have in the Children's Act got provisions which talk about prevention and early intervention and seek to provide support to families, and particularly those families that struggle under the most difficult circumstances. We're very concerned. Honourable Swart has repeatedly suggested that the crime of statutory rape or statutory sexual assault saves us when the crime of rape or the crime of sexual assault fails. So he's talked about it, I refer to it as a fallback crime. So when this very serious thing happens of rape, where there's no consent, where there's any kind of coercion, or where there's an abuse of power, all of which falls under the definition of consent in the rape definition, the suggestion has been that we could then use this for the words competent verdict to have been used. I think that is an extremely problematic position to take. I think that when you have a law that is meant for a certain purpose, and if implementation is a problem, you deal with the implementation of that law. You don't leave pieces of law that are having very negative consequences in place to pick up, and I know this from experience, there's very few cases that are referred in that way through the courts. In fact, I've dealt with families who are completely perplexed as to why the courts don't use that. So I don't think that we can talk about this as a fallback crime. Then, Chairperson, the Women Legal Centre spoke to the issue of the discretion to in terms of the decision to prosecute a matter where you have an age gap of less of more than 2 years between young people. And, Chairperson, you suggested that one big problem with their submission of the decision only being taken by the National Director of Public Prosecutions is the concern of bottlenecking and holding up a system if you vest that decision in one person. We do not know exactly how many cases of this nature are likely to go through the courts. We don't have statistics on the current cases, and therefore I can't say to you whether it will be a high or a small number of cases and the extent to which that might bottleneck the system. But we're very concerned about inconsistencies in application across different courts. So we're highly concerned that a child in one area will be treated in one way and a child in another area will be treated in a different way. So for these reasons, we support that submission that be the NDPP to make the decision. But we have heard your concerns and would then ask, sir, in the event that you do keep the decision at the level of the directors of public prosecutions at provincial level, that you then consider removing the clause which gives them the discretion to delegate that further down. Because that would then vest the power in 9 offices across the country and avoid a situation where senior prosecutors and sometimes possibly the junior prosecutors are making a call which would very much be based on their personal decisions. 2 last points. The one is we've got submissions that the age should be lowered from 12 to 10, and we do not agree that that is necessary. There were some concerns regarding a lacuna that the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office raised in terms of the 11-year-olds who are in consenting situations. In our opinion, the law which protects anyone under 12 against any sexual activity, irrespective of their consent, and decides that it's being raped is good and necessary. And in instances where that is taking place with another child of similar age, it is covered in the Child Justice Act. So that second child should still be dealt with, in our view, under the definition of rape. And the systems of inquiry, of assessment, possible diversion, should that be necessary, would kick in. Also alert you to the fact that committee will need to be looking at the review of the minimum age of criminal capacity shortly. Another deadline headache, I'm sure, in light of all of the work you have before you. But that may also address some of the concerns in terms of lowering age. We also strongly disagree with the notion of raising the age to 18. We think that will exacerbate the issues that we currently face, and suspect very much would then require more intervention by the courts in terms of those 15 and 17-year-olds, where currently the court has only made decisions relating to the under-15s. Chairperson, I'll leave it there in passing to my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. As Sam said, my name is Lorenzo Wakefield, and I'll be representing the Centre for Justice and Crime Prevention. I'll be speaking a lot about an issue which I was concerned isn't a lot of engagement, not a lot of submissions being brought to the committee on it, and that relates to the Sex Offenders Register and the dating of children's names on the Sex Offenders Register. Now, we know that there were about two other submissions on this, and when this was presented, there wasn't much engagement by the committee on this, and we feel that there is a bit of more engagement on the technical issue and what the bill proposes, whether that is actually in the best interest of children. Now, the Sexual Offences Act currently allows for an automatic placement of a child's name on a sex offender's register. In other words, if a child is convicted of a sexual offence, his or her name must go on the register. Now, this is in the case of J versus the NDPP. This is what the Constitutional Court found to be unconstitutional because it doesn't allow for what it says is an individualized approach. Now, many organizations that have presented here have spoken about this individualized approach, and I'm sure that the organization after this will speak about this approach. But I would like to take this back to the example. There's also another provision in the Sexual Offence Act that states that where a person commits more than one sexual offence, their name has to go on the register for life. And I should take this back to what the Women's Legal Centre presented in the example of a selfie being taken and sent to somebody. So if a child takes a selfie and sends it to somebody, it is provocative enough. It might mean production of pornography and as well as distribution of pornography. And if he or she sends it to another child, that's an offense against another child, which would mean that that child's name goes on that register for life. And the court has made very clear about the impact and the consequences of having your name for life on the sex offenders register. And we feel that this might not be a fair proposition to such children. Now, the bill, as it currently stands, speaks about this individualized approach. It encompasses that individualized approach. We would like to make a presentation on and contextualize this a little bit. Now, the proposed amendment, as I said, does allow for this individualized approach. But, Chairperson, it allows for from a very discriminatory premise. What we currently see is that the bill says that all children's names must go on the register, so it's automatic placement. And then, if needs be, the child has to make representations as to why his or her name should not go on the register. Now, that all in well sounds logic, it sounds fair, but it's not fair towards children who might not have the resources to make those representations. And what we expect to see as a consequence from this is that what's happening is that you're going to have children that are well-resourced, whose parents are well-resourced, that will be able to go to get psychological and psychiatric assessments and therefore would be in a better position to make such representation as opposed to children who are not well-resourced, as opposed to children who are from the rural areas. And such an unequal premise already shows that premise is not fair from that position. Now, we all know that the reason, or why we expect the reasons why this is currently the way it is one, because assessments are costly. It's costly to the state, it costs a lot of money. And what we want to propose is a mechanism that, one, is in the best interest of children as per Section 28(2) of the Constitution, and also would mitigate the cost of these assessments and representation to the state. And from this position, we propose in our submission that we have as a starting point, so as a as the fundamental rule that no child's name goes on the register unless the prosecutor applies to have a child's name put on the register. In other words, the prosecutors argue you that this offense is grave enough that the child might commit a sexual offense in the future. So in other words, it takes the premise that yes, there are instances where children's names should go on the register, and that should be noted, and that should be left at the discretion of the prosecutor and the court in the instance. In that way, only then would we argue that an assessment by a suitable person should follow, and the court should make an order based on this assessment. That's where you would see sort of a filtering mechanism in place to ensure that only those children's names who should be on the register go on the register. In conclusion, we would like to raise a deeply concerning concern with the provision as it currently stands for children whose names have been on the register since 2007 or when the Act came into implementation. Now, the Act states that such child, in other words, these are parents, and such child must apply to have their names expunged from the register. Now, is our assertion that in many instances children might not even know that the names are on the register and will only find out once they need to apply for a job somewhere when they're an adult. And secondly, that just even to engage a bureaucratic system in itself is an intense procedure for everyone, and let alone for children for that matter. What we propose is that the names as it currently stands on the register was placed there by the state, and therefore the state has the duty to make an assessment of whether the names should be on there or not, and if so, should then apply to have the names or should then remove the names from those registers that we foresee will not commit sexual offences in the future. So that's important, the requirement that we are placing on this on these provisions on the Act. We propose in conclusion, Chair, that this should be done within a reasonable amount of time, and the goals is for the Act to specify this amount of time to possibly be 1 year. Thank you very much.
Well, you ask for a minute and you don't use it. Let's send it out there. Thank you very much. What we'll do is we'll get a presentation and then we can take questions. Center for Health Law. Professor Stetson.
Honourable members, thank you for this opportunity to be able to speak to you. My name is Anne Skelton. I am the director of the Centre for Child Law, which is based at the University of Pretoria. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to address you, as we at the Centre have had a very long-standing involvement in the two Constitutional Court cases from which these submissions arise. I myself was directly involved as one of the counsel in the Teddy Bear Clinic case, and I was counsel for the amici curiae in the Jane matter. So I've been dealing with the detail of this over many, a number of years now. Why did we decide during the Teddy Bear Clinic case? Well, it came about because specialists who are dealing with children who'd been referred for diversion, for example, under that law, were telling us it just didn't fit to deal with these children as offenders. Simply didn't make any sense because they weren't offenders. And in the Jules High School case, there were additional concerns that made it seem as though the girl who'd originally started off saying that she was a victim of rape got transformed into an offender during the course at all times without her being legally represented. Some of you may have seen this article in the Sunday Times that was published on Sunday. And Shida Omar, who spoke last week, mentioned she actually was the person who counseled the girls in the Jules High School case. His name is Christina. But her name has only now been made public because what this newspaper report tells us is that she subsequently committed suicide. And Chida didn't tell her that Bahit because she was protecting the privacy. She did tell you that the girl was very, very traumatized and how difficult it was working with somebody who was essentially a victim of drunken situation, who was then treated as an offender under the law. So I think it's a sobering thing that the family has now decided to speak out, and we respected previously that her privacy should be protected, which we would always do, but as the family has now decided to make it known that she died, possibly in the hopes that for girls like Christina, and for boys also, this new law will provide the protection that those of us that work with children are seeking to gain for them through our challenge to the law in the Teddy Bezenek case. The Jay case is obviously different. It's about sexual offences. So now we are really talking about children who commit crimes, which we have acknowledged all the way through. It's certainly the case, but we shouldn't mix up the two. I have heard here and there during submissions made to this committee that people do get these things mixed up. It's very different if we're talking about consensual sexual activity or if we're talking about an offence. But what the Constitutional Court said in the Jay case is that even if we are talking about an offence, when we deal with child offenders, we must treat them differently from when we deal with adult offenders. The purpose of the Sex Offenders Register is to protect children from adults who are sexually interested in children. It stops them from working with children. As I'm sure you know, it's not a public register, it's a confidential register. And when you want to employ somebody to work with children, you as the employer have to check against the register whether that person is on the register. That obviously does limit the rights of people to work. That's no problem if they are adult sex offenders. We all accept in the children's rights sector that that is a very wise protection of children. However, to assume that all children who have been convicted of sexual offences will grow up to become adult offenders turns out to be wrong. It sounds like it might be right, but in fact all the research shows us that child sex offenders do not, for the large part, grow up to be adult sex offenders. There are some indicators, though, that would tell you that there may be an ongoing problem. And workshops that we've been having in civil society sector, we've been trying to come to grips with what some of those would be. So, for example, if there was a very big gap between the offender and the victim in age, that would be an indicator that there may be a problem later in life. Because, you see, although it might be normal for a 14-year-old to be sexually interested in a 14-year-old, it's not normal for a 14-year-old to be sexually interested in a 3-year-old. And similarly, although it's okay for 14-year-olds to be sexually interested in 14-year-olds, it's not okay for 30-year-olds to be sexually interested. So you can see that there's a normalness about being sexually interested in a child if you are the same age as them, but not if you're not the same age. So big difference in age would be an indicator. Another one would be violence used in the course of the crime. And in fact, in Jay's own case, there was quite a lot of violence used. So Jay might be one of those children, child offenders, whose name ought to go on the sex offender register. So when we started debating this in our sector, and it would be interesting for you to know that the coalition of NGOs working on this, some of them come from offender organisations, if I can look at it that way. I mean, organisations that work with offenders traditionally, like NICRA, and others come from a sector that is more focused on the rights of victims. And you've actually heard a lot from organisations here who deal with victims' rights. The Central Child Law deals with both. So we say to ourselves, now how is the sector going to feel about this? Because on the one hand, we're saying this law aims, the register aims to protect victims, but we're talking about child offenders too. Well, to our satisfaction, we were able to find, very easy, to find common ground. And what the children's rights organisations who work with victims said is, we don't want an absolute ban that children's names should never go on the register. What we want is to see that's the general rule that they don't go on the register, but there may be cases. Through an assessment, we could work out which ones pose an actual risk. And those ones, there could be an application for them to go on the register. But of course, in keeping with the principle of what lawyers call audi alteram partem, and others being allowed to give your side of the story before a final decision is made, children should be given an opportunity to argue with the support of an assessment whether or not their names should go on the register. So the assessment might say that their names should go on the register, but they would still have a chance to say, but I'm very young and I don't think my name should go on the register. And then the court will decide which case go on the register. So after the court cases, as you know then, the matters were referred back to this Honourable House for determinations to be made about the wording, and the Department of Justice came up with it all. And I'm pleased to be able to say that I think the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development has done an excellent job on this bill. The Centre for Child Law entirely supports the provisions that arise from the Teddy Mechanic. Without any exception, we think that those provisions are good. And we've thought about them a lot, we've looked at them a lot, we've try to see if we can come up with a better formulation. We don't think we can. So thank you very much to the Department of Justice for support for the bill. When it comes to the J part of the bill, I can put it that way, those parts of the bill that arise from the J case, we are just a little bit worried, and I think what Lorenzo Wakefield said earlier, I would like to echo, that is that perhaps the bill is the wrong way around. It partially just last to what the Constitutional Court said in the Jay case. In other words, we can see that there is an attempt there to improve it, because it does just, the way the law formulated now, it does give child offenders the opportunity to make presentations. But it still means that in the general approach is all children's names go on the sex offenders register. Now, the Constitutional Court said that they were uncomfortable with that, because an individualized approach needs to be taken when it comes to children. In other words, let's not treat them all the same. You can't work out the best interests of children and all the fine balancing act that you need if you start from the point that all will go on the register. You should rather start from the point that none will go on the register as an automatic provision. But the prosecutor, who's got all the facts, they know previous convictions, they know the whole situation, they've got the detailed statements of the witness. The prosecutor can give notice to the court that I am going to apply to place this child on the register. And I think we can trust our prosecutors to do that. I, in my work, often have to cross swords with prosecutors. They take their work very seriously. They don't like to let children off hook, believe me, when you're arguing on the other side. So we can trust prosecutors to say, right, I am going to apply to put this child on the register. But that's not the end of it, because we must give children the opportunity, their lawyers, to put their side of the story. And because assessments are so important in determining the long-term risk, we say that in those cases, there should be an assessment, and it should be paid for at state expense. And it would be anyway if they're legally represented, but I don't think we're asking for something that wouldn't automatically already happen. But what we are saying is let's tailor it. Let's tailor it to the cases where the prosecutor thinks the child may be a risk to society when they're older, and let's get a professional assessment. And many other good things will come out of those assessments. The people who work on the psychosocial side say, this would be very useful for us to know about interventions that could be made, counselling and therapeutic services that could be done. And when we're dealing with child sex offenders, there is still a chance that we can get them to grow up to be adults who do not commit any sexual offenders, because they're still malleable in their development and their sexuality. They sometimes get the wire crossed. People don't explain sex to children, so therefore they sometimes experiment and they do wrong things. And those things can sometimes be crumbs. But what we're saying is let's then try and find out what are we really dealing with. Are we really dealing with a child who's already showing violence and likely to be a sex offender? Well, in that case, there needs to be a child victim such that we would need to put those children's names on the register. But if we're dealing with a child who, with some therapy and help and some gender sensitivity training, etc., I'm a lawyer, not an expert in those fields, but I'm told by all my colleagues who are very knowledgeable in this, that you can do a lot. If the state, instead of being obsessed with prosecution and registers, would think about intervention, treatment, and putting these young people on the right path, that is the very best way to protect child victims in the future. And so we must think in terms of a more protective approach, a more thorough approach, and we say that the best way to achieve that is through having a general approach that no child goes on the sex offenders register unless the prosecution gives notice. And then we say that actually it should be quite a high standard approved. So we've actually opted for that there should be substantial and compelling reasons to put a child's name on the register. We've chosen that because there's already quite a lot of case law about what substantial and compelling means. So it's quite useful to hang it on that, because it's not theoretical. The courts already know what that means, and so that's what we've done. So on page 7 of our written submissions, we've actually done something that I hope the drafters will find useful, and that is that we've actually set out exactly how we think our proposals could be achieved through amendments to the bill. Kirsten, I think that's really, in a nutshell, all that the Center for Child Law wanted to put forward to the committee.
Thank you, Professor, but when you say assessment must be at the expense of the state, I'm aware that social workers employed by the state do assessments, but there are also social workers that are in private practice. So what are you suggesting? Do you mean that if I go to a private social worker, the state must also pay?
Well, the way I understand it is that where the defense asks for an assessment to be done, which is I think what would happen if in the scheme that we are proposing, already those assessments are paid for by the state. That's what I understand, that because it's part of the government's structure, Legal Aid asks for a report, then it's paid for by the state in any case. So I don't think that we are asking for anything that isn't already available. In fact, what we're doing is trying to narrow down the number of cases in which that would happen. Because at the moment, if any defense lawyer asks for such an assessment, it will be provided. And if you're a good lawyer, and the rule is every child must go on the register, then you should ask for an assessment. I would. And that would be very, very expensive. And it would also tie up specialists endlessly in many, many assessments of children who actually don't need that much attention. So what we're saying is let's narrow it down. Then we can get proper assessments done by suitably qualified persons. It would be at the expense of the state, but my point is it already is. So if you leave the bill as it stands now, that will still happen. But it will be more cases that will be brought into the system. What we are saying is target it. Pay for it, and we as society will benefit because we will know what kind of offender we're dealing with then. And so I don't think that we're asking for something that should already be being budgeted for if it's part of, if this bill had already been considered in terms of the cost indications, but what we are proposing would reduce the cost.
Yeah. We will use the Incredible Help for the Child Justice Act, and did we not there put in every child that is charged needs a social worker assessment? Remember, if I remember correctly, and confront times with that initial assessment was a second, if you're going to have a social worker already involved in every case, is that not a way of, obviously it's the choice of the defense if they want to use another social worker, but there you've already got a social worker that is involved in that case, and they could then possibly do a second assessment when it comes to the issue you're talking about, or you're talking about something totally separate.
Well, I think that's certainly something that could be debated. Yes, a probation officer assesses a child before they come to court, and also can be asked to do a pre-sentence report. And in these kinds of serious cases, the probation officers will always be doing a pre-sentence report. It's true. Whether or not probation officers are really the right people to be doing this assessment is, I think, the debate that needs to happen. They are social workers, which means they all do have university degrees. They certainly at the moment are not trained to undertake this kind of assessment. It is quite difficult, and we've debated enough to could you have a kind of a tool, like a, tick the blocks, and I know that some, Jones and Egan, are very opposed to a block ticking, for example, but there are others in the group that sort of think maybe one could train people and develop the skills. We've got to be realistic, I suppose, but at the same time, what we are saying is the space would then be open, at least, for legal aid in the cases that they think are deserving, as long as there is an understanding that, I worry that if I look at the Jay case, that boy, his family didn't have any money and they didn't care about it. So nobody from his family would have bothered. But for us in society, it's important to know about Jay, because Jay could be a danger to the community. So it's an investment if we do pay for it. So I would say that what we propose in our draft provisions that we're offering for consideration is that the assessment should be done by a suitably qualified person, and that would be determined through regulation. That will give the department time to think about the cost implications and whether who's qualified or for what, and certainly civil society would very much like to be involved in any engagements to work out how do we do that assessment risk.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair, for giving us the opportunity of sharing a few thoughts from the General Counsel of the Bar. Firstly, this is rather a strange meeting because normally it's in courts that we argue these matters once the problem has arisen. I foresee as from the, at the outset, like I say, that I foresee as further challenge in a constitutional court if this bill goes ahead in its present form. And I say so because it's a very touchy subject. We have adolescents that experiment, that's life. People do it. And unfortunately, to try and impose strictures and legal attitudes onto children of that nature can cause harm, and probably does cause harm. You can imagine what happens, and this is set out in the Tibet case. What happens to a child that is faced with corpses when they are experimenting in life? They're starting out and they don't know things, the parents don't teach them things, so they experiment, children do. And it's a problem that the courts will have to deal with, which is, is essentially the wrong institution. Criminalizing people has repercussions that we can't even think about. If you place a child in the criminal justice system, place him in front of a prosecutor in a court, and a defense counsel, and have a magistrate sitting up top looking down on you, that's going to scar a child. Far more than the sexual experience. Sexual experiences happen in life. And I would urge that when consideration is given to this act, that the adolescent experimentation be given preference, foremost and at the front of every single idea that is imposed, and that the law courts are used as a last resort. Now, problems that I foresee and that have been raised by associate members of the bar are the following. A person is not defined in an act, and this could be problematic. Thus, person A could possibly be younger than the child B, as set out in the definitions in 15 and 16, yet remain the accused in a prosecution. For instance, a child at ages 10 and 12 years could actually penetrate a child more than 2 years older and be prosecuted under the proposed amendment. But as it is formulated, however, if the second child is within 2 years of the other child, the new child, or sorry, the first child, will escape prosecution. Perhaps this warrants further clarification as that the ideological purpose of it is to protect the younger and more vulnerable individual. The second scenario is the artificial distinction between the accused and the complainant raised in that. In theory, it permits a scenario whereby two boys below 16 years of age with an age gap exceeding 2 years, they consent to homosexual penetration if only the one performing the penetration will get prosecuted. This is an arbitrary distinction. Scenario 3, the arbitrary 2 year age difference and consequences. It permits 2 12-year-old children to perform sexual penetration together, but criminalizes sexual penetration between a child aged 1 day shy of 14 years and one shy of 50 years. The amendment suggested in Tibet by the High Court doesn't criminalize consensual sexual penetrative acts between children. However, the proposed amendment bill creates a wide scope for a plethora of possible and tenable scenarios. Essentially, the de facto age of consent will be reduced to 12 years of age, so long provided the partner is not older or younger by 24 months. Furthermore, it is respectfully submitted that the proposed amendment bill is prima facie not in line with the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the Teddy Bear Clinic case, and the possibility remains that it will be open to constitutional challenge. To the amendment of Section 60. Now, similarly, those comments apply to Section 16 that I set out in commentary on Section 50. And it must be noted that since the term sexual violation envisages a far wider spectrum of actions than sexual penetration, it compounds the existence of possible untenable circumstances. As regards the amendment to Section 50 of Act 32, the
proposed amendment bill, section applications 2E3, affords a convicted person under the subsection the opportunity to make representations why such an order should not be made. It is suggested that the term representation is inappropriate from a practical point of view. In criminal law, nomenclature representations presupposes a written document from an accused to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. In this scenario, it clearly isn't the same and may cause confusion. If the intention is that the convicted person should give oral evidence, then that should be stated. If this is not the intention, then it should be clarified in the legislation. The use of the word representation is confusing and should perhaps be reconsidered. We also submit that guidelines as to what the nature of the representation should entail, for it to be given due and proper considerations, would be useful. By analogy, such as those set out in the Criminal Procedure Act 51 of 1977, relating to the granting of bail.
That's my submission. Thank you, Mr. Bass. As we agreed, we will now take questions to all the presenters. You may take but you are sitting behind the pillar, that's the problem. So if you go back, you will disappear. So you better lean here so we can see you. Honorable members, the floor is open. Honorable Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the submissions. Firstly, to say thank you. We have engaged on this issue. And I think it's irrefutable that the fallback position we're going to lose at with the decriminalization. Wait, you can put something in front. It's easier for me to see her there. Okay. I need you to respond to this. Just on your mention, Sam, of the fallback position. One of the aims of the Act was to prevent secondary trauma of victims, and we know that one out of nine rape cases is reported because of the issue of secondary trauma of having to disprove consent. And I think that is what I was trying to make that point, but clearly that is academic now, because the court has said there can't be decriminalisation. But can I just ask you, I think the concern is, and I might have been guilty of it myself in the initial stages, of confusing the age of consent with decriminalisation. The issue is the public's perception at the moment. How do we deal with that? That the average layman doesn't understand the difference between decriminalisation and, as Advocate King said, the de facto dropping of the age of consent to 12. And I think that is an issue that is the responsibility of all of us. Linked to that is the inconsistent ages that we've got that we're going to have to look at as well. Last week we had a debate on Women's Day and the issue of adoption came up. That a child cannot give his baby up for adoption unless, I think you're 16, that a child can have an abortion at an age of 8 or 10. So those are some of the problems. But the direct question is, in the light of the possibility of the review of the minimum age of criminal consent, criminal capacity, to 14, what would your view be to lifting the age of consent to 14? And that, I think all of us need to consider that, to bring some level of consistency with some of the ages. And then secondly, just to deal with that issue of the message that is being sent out and the need for education on that issue. Thirdly, it's an issue which I raised with Anne as well, and that is the involvement of a mechanism in terms of the Children's Act, so that we from Parliament can at least say, let's empower the families, and in certain circumstances, it could well be that we might be dealing with a child in need of care. And I'd just like your comments on that we might put something in a resolution along those lines. I think it is a danger. We focus so much on the issue of decriminalization, we're not really looking at the register. So I think that is also a very important aspect, and Lorenzo have pointed out. But I'd just like your comments on that issue. Chair, should I put the question to everyone, or should you just ask how do you want to deal with it? And thank you for your input and your work, and again, I was just shocked to read about the suicide in the Sunday papers and have a clear understanding now of what we thought at the time, diversion being a very good option, not fully appreciating the trauma that children do go through. And you yourself, where are you then? You helped us draft that act, and you know our intention was always very positive, and I think a lot has been learned out from the teddy bear clinic, and it's given me a lot to think about as well. And just on Sam, the issue that the fallback position, it cuts both ways, because I was also the Women's Legal Centre giving where a child that lays a rape charge and can't prove or that she did not give consent, she can then be charged as absolutely an unintended consequence. So that way of those baskets to me is very relevant. But and also just the issue of lifting the age to 14, to consider that in view of the probable lifting of the minimum age of criminal capacity to 14, and then secondly the issue of some mechanism from in terms of the Children's Act to empower families, because clearly the state has got a role to play, as the Constitutional Court pointed out, that it has this legitimate and important interest in deterring adolescents from premature sexual behaviour. So there is a role to play. There's a role for families. But that was the narrow ambit that the court played. And then I was going to ask you, just to tie up the issue of the assessment, I think you've dealt with that with the parole officer, social worker that has come in, that you actually think you recommend a separate one. And then William Hewitt as well, Advocate King, we go back a long time. We used to prosecute together many, many years ago. Very successfully. I in fact appeared before the magistrate King in those days. Similarly, what would your comment be on lifting the age to 14 or 15? But at this stage, people say 18, but I do understand the constitutional challenges of that. But 14, in view of the probable lifting of the minimum criminal capacity age, 14, and doing away with the rebuttable presumption. Thank you.
I just don't want you to call them N and William, because I wanted to call you Honorable Schwartz.
Yeah, you can call me, Steve. I know this is not intended.
Not today. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Steve Schwartz. Look, I think you, as a member of this committee, have known me in the various incarnations, be it working at Rape Crisis, at RACCAN, and now at the Community Law Centre over the years, and I think you know that our work is very committed to dealing with the issue of secondary victimisation, weak and very often non-existent access to justice for survivors of sexual violence. And problems not just in the criminal justice system, but also more broadly socially and in terms of social services. So it is absolutely something that I lose sleep over frequently, and I think people always tell me I'm too emotional and passionate, and I always disagree that that's an issue. But it's critical. I do not think that the issue of having this as some fallback for those rape matters which happen to affect people in a very narrow age gap is a way to deal with problems in secondary victimization. And we have addressed this committee, and this committee has also been addressed by the department on measures being taken regarding sexual offences courts, resolving those calls, what works in our system. And I would say that that should be where the discussion to address secondary victimization takes place, and not actually regarding consensual acts and decriminalisation of acts between two young people, neither of whom are experiencing harm through the experience. You mentioned the issue of public perception, and talk about the average layman. You know, they're very different averages. South Africa is a very mixed bag of people, and you can talk about the rural or the urban or the white or the black, but actually that doesn't tell you
what each category or each grouping, whether it's the educated left or the educated right and so forth, it doesn't actually tell you what people think. So I believe very much in this concept of deliberation, this idea that we create a democracy that goes beyond participatory democracy to one where we have opportunities to put ideas across to people and people can engage with those ideas. We can do that on small scales. Dear person, you spoke about media that you've been approached to speak to, and as have I and a number of our colleagues in this room. And I think it is about using those platforms to pose the key questions, yes, to provide information or education on what the Constitutional Court case means. But I was gratified to be on Cairo FM recently, and every single caller, out of about 10 callers, showed support for the notion that this should not be a crime, but rather should be something that is dealt with by families, religious communities, and social services. So I think that it is a duty for us to educate and build deliberation amongst South Africans. The fact is, we do all agree we want measures to prevent early sexual debut. In terms of the inconsistencies of ages, I wonder if Professor Skelton Mind, if I defer that to, for her response. I think she is far more expert in the range of laws and issues relating to ages, including their inconsistencies. As a Dutch response, I am cautious around the suggestion of raising the age to 14. I would personally want to do more research. I've said we try and take evidence-based positions in terms of what we ask for in policy and programming. I want to do a bit more research to understand what the impact of that would be on normal behavior among 12 and 13-year-olds. You've couched that very carefully, saying, well, this is also in light of the likelihood that the age of minimum criminal capacity will be raised. My understanding is it's raising from 10 to 12, and the question of what happens to 12 to 14 is still up in the air. So I'd be cautious about making a decision now against a conversation that hasn't yet taken place and that has got its own moving part. And then lastly, in terms of what to do in the mechanism, I don't know what presume to tell the committee what to do, but most certainly would encourage some engagement between this committee and the departments and committees dealing with health, social development and education. I think I've covered them all. Thank you.
Honourable Swart asked a question about how are we going to get the message across? It was actually for Ms. Waterhouse. But I will try and answer. How are we going to get the message out that actually this is not about knowing the age of consent? And what's been so interesting about the TTB clinic case from the beginning is it's been as important to talk about what the case was not about as it was to talk about what it is about. And in fact, if you read the judgments, the judge does it as well. She said this case is not about knowing the age of consent. And I think the answer to that is we must, ask the media to help us reflect this. And it doesn't help when people keep on saying things like, this electorally lowers the age of consent, and I've heard it said twice already this morning. So that's, if we want to get the message out that it doesn't, please, let's just tell the truth. It doesn't. So that's important, and children should be given, they should be perhaps, education for teenagers is you're not allowed to have sex until you're 16. We know that if they do, they won't face in the criminal law, but the rule still is, you're not allowed to have sex until you're 16. And I find it amusing to see that those of us who are involved in the case, and as a middle-aged woman, I find it amusing that I'm being seen as encouraging teenagers to have sex. My sons, who are now in their 20s, say they don't remember me being so aggressive when they were teenagers. but the point is, we're not encouraging teenagers to have sex. All we're saying is we don't think the criminal law is placed to try and deal with it. And that brings me to the next question, which was the question about whether or not there should be some kind of resolution. Now, I'm not sure if I understand the effect of the resolution. What I don't think would be a good idea to put something actually in the Sexual Offences Act, because that, again, brings this into the domain of the criminal law, which I think the Constitutional Court has clearly said we don't want it in the domain of the criminal law. But beefing up the Children's Act or increasing the preventive clauses, no problem. And in fact, there are going to be opportunities. There is a second amendment bill, it's called, coming to Parliament quite soon of the Children's Act. And there is, in fact, the DA has a bill, and I believe the department also has a bill, so I don't know how that's all going to come out. And then there is another third amendment bill to the Children's Act, which is coming down the line, should be in Parliament probably by next year. And so there are lots of opportunities. But I guess it would just be important for you in your party structures as MPs to make sure that your colleagues who are on the Social Development Portfolio Committee are going to have to flag those issues for you there, or you're going to have to talk to them or whatever. So yes, I would support that. I think it's a good idea. And I expect there may be some children who might be in need of care protection due to their sexual activity, but I would imagine that that would be the minority of cases. In other words, we shouldn't cast the net so wide that we draw every adolescent who's experimenting sexually into the care and protection net. The system will not cope with it, apart from anything else. But it will be rocked as well. And then the question about lifting the minimum age to 14. It's worth debating. And I need to think a bit about it more, because I guess it's saying that nobody below 14 would be criminalised. But I'm a little bit worried about the offenders. Sorry to be, I know you won't expect me to be, but I am, because of child offenders and young offenders. I always have to think about that. What would the impact be? Because if you, at the moment, had sex with a person who's below the age of 14, 12, then that is rape. There is no, it doesn't matter what she said or he said or anything. It's rape, and that's very good. It attracts minimum sentences. It's harsh. And so if we raise that to 40, we do what we call net widening. We draw more people into the harsh treatment of the criminal justice system. And most of those people will be young. And they'll be normal people who are having sexual interactions. We must be very, very careful. If you are a young person and you're only a few years older than the 13-year-old, we must be very, very careful that we don't then throw the book at those people and treat them in the same way as people who actually, you know, use violence and violate people. It's very different. And our law is not good at finding those nuances. I'm concerned about it. So that would be my one response. The other response is, what about how does it go with the minimum age of criminal responsibility? Well, it is a bit of a dilemma, because I would find myself on the side that would want to say that I'd like to raise the minimum age of criminal capacity to 14. So it sounds like I'm wanting to win on all sides of this debate. And as I say, I think it does require more debate. Let me say, though, that 2 weeks ago there was a workshop held by the Department of Justice on the very issue of the review of the minimum age of criminal responsibility. And the Deputy Minister, John Jeffrey, spoke at that workshop, and he said that although government has not yet taken a firm position on what the position will be, he thinks that there is a great deal of evidence to raise the minimum age to 12 with the removal of the Dole In-Care Act presumption. At that workshop, though, there was a lot of support, 14, amongst the people who were there. And so it may be that we will see something that falls halfway between the two, something like raising it to 12 for now, but putting up in another review clause and having some protection for 12. And so, you know, so those are the debates that are on the table. The key part, I think, is going to be it will be quite dangerous to raise it to 14 here, and then you don't manage to raise it to 14 in the child justice. It would be perfect if you could do it at the same time, but I don't know whether that's going to be possible for you to get that other review. I understand that there's a report coming to you before the end of this month on the review of the minimum age criminal responsibility. But whether you would be able to, and I also understand that you've asked for, you're going to be asking for a postponement of this till August. So you would know your processes better than I do. I don't know whether it's possible to deal with this at the same time. There would be a lot of logic in doing so, I think, on that particular point. But most of the other issues I don't think one needs to wait for. And obviously we would not want to see significant delays in any of these processes. So if the one is going to hold up the other, then we would be worried about that.
Yes. Trying to determine the age of Jay. I think he was 40. He was 14. So maybe he was 13 and 11 months when he committed the crime. Does that mean that he couldn't be prosecuted because he's incompetent to have sex? We know he did. And I didn't do it. And the three boys. So, it's a fact of life. 13-year-olds engage in sexual contact. What happens in life? And surely we should rather engage in looking at what the 13-year-olds of this world would want. Has there ever been a study made with the 13-year-olds of the aim of the study? So some person goes and interviews across the range of, and across the spectrum of South Africa, interview those people that are 13 that possibly would be engaging in sexual contact. Find out what they think.
they're the bulk of people that we're going to be looking at. They're going to be 13, 14, 15, 16 and involved in a criminal act that we're dealing with. So then peer review it rather than having debates and get a proper study going. We have the ability to do it in South Africa to get their input. I don't believe that raising the age of consent is age 12. Just look at your own life. I mean, you all have stories of people that mature, or children, adolescents mature far earlier than others. And examples of that. And to actually put an age onto something like this, that if it's the right thing, just not like, oh, sorry, feel like it's the right thing to do. So I would be against raising that age.
I think this should bring us to the end of this session, which was good because it has raised issues, offered proposals, and that will empower the honourable members to take the matters forward. Is there someone who still feels they want to raise something?
I think, and the Honourable Professor, the issue when you said, and I think that is we need to note that the age is actually still 16. I think that is so key to get that broader into the public domain, and that the decriminalisation does not affect that. So I think that is absolutely critical that we all appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Unal Meshkori and my colleague, Mr. Chidima Sekwa, from Triangle Victim Empowerment Program. This is a non-government organization which exists to generate an attitude of zero tolerance towards domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse. Firstly, I would like to thank the committee and Mr. Person to appreciate for giving us an opportunity to make submissions on this law reform that is crucial and relevant in our lives. Maybe first, I'd want us to just imagine ourselves back in the days when we were teenagers. When we first experienced our first sexual feelings or attraction, how it felt like, and what measures or steps did we take when we felt that sexual feelings. As it stands right now, Section 15 and 16 of the Sexual Offences Act provides that consensual sexual activities of adolescents between 12 and 16 is a sexual violation. This sexual activities include kissing, touching, as well as sexual contact. This act provides that such adolescents involved are prosecuted if found to be engaging in consensual sexual activities. It further on states that such adolescents should, if found guilty, be placed automatically on the National Register of Sex Offenders. We feel that the above sections should be amended to include that adolescents between the ages of 12 and 16 should not be criminalized for engaging in consensual sexual activities, and that they should not be automatically placed on the National Register of Sex Offenders. The reason we say this is, for example, PVP works in tribal communities, and some of the incidents are as a result of community practices and traditions. And as such, the adolescents still have to explore sexual activities with each other. They are young. They want to experiment. Regardless of the law, the workshops and campaigns that are using prevention mechanisms, they still want to experiment. As such, they suffer more harm because of the consequences that are associated with unprotected sex. The obligation to report imposes more consequences to sanction practice on the children as they end up practicing unsafe abortion to prevent them and their partners from being charged if they consult with their health services. This is where we find children going to back door to get abortions, which lead to so many complications and so many problems. In most of traditional circumstances, as I said, we're based in a rural area. Initiates are teenagers who, after being initiated, they come back to the community. They want to experiment. They want to explore their sexual feelings. They want to explore what they're feeling. They want to get involved in sexual activities. If the provision of the law is still like it is as it stands, we'll have a generation of people with criminal records, which will make it impossible for them to secure employment. Imagine 60% of adolescents having criminal records by just exploring sexual feelings. What kind of future will we have? We should keep in mind that adolescents or the young ones are the future. Children are human beings with inherent human dignity. They have rights, and their social rights are inborn natural rights. It's something that is inside, something that they feel inside. Let us not allow our children to be persecuted and traumatized. There is the Jude High School case. We were recently told by Honorable and that she had committed suicide. Let us not subject our children to trauma by criminalizing them for involving in sexual activities. We need not punish them for expressing how they feel. Let us educate, sensitize, and guide our children in what needs to be done and what are the correct ways to do it in order to steer them into the right direction. This is my submission, but I have over to my colleague.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just two issues. The first one is that prosecution of disease is contextual sexual intercourse between children is a problem. Because you find that there's no competent witness. The children are not willing to go through the criminal justice system, and the parents as well are not supporting these children. Because there's no parent who will support you so that at the end of the day, the child will write the criminal record. And the end result is that it's just a waste of resources. Because PED, if they are given essential services, as an example, PED is expensive. It costs almost 800 rands. On the other hand, red kit as well is very expensive. And those are the things that we must use in collecting evidence. But you know that those places will not be thrown out of court. So why waste the resources? So then on the other end result is that, you know, those children will suffer from severe trauma. And it will need a lot of resources also to, in terms of counseling them to continue with their normal lives. Thank you.
This is probably, I thought that initiation to children abstinence, you seem to say that it encourages them to experiment. What is the correct question?
Honorable Chairperson, traditional initiations teach children to abstain. They are informed of social activities. But when the children go into their communities, they want to explore what they are being taught because they are also feeling it inside them.
Initiation is not effective. It doesn't achieve the purpose. Are you saying that?
Sorry?
Are you saying that the initiation doesn't achieve the purpose of teaching the children to abstain? Actually, encourages them to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't. Actually, it stimulates interest. It stimulates interest in sexual activities.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Haley Dalgett. I'll be representing the Gender Health and Justice Research Unit this morning. The unit is based at the University of Cape Town and is an interdisciplinary research unit that unites academic, civil society, and expert practitioners in the field in the collaborative pursuit of the elimination of violence against women and children, both in Southern Africa as well as beyond. We thank the Portfolio Committee for the opportunity to present today, and I see our submission is being handed out as we speak. As a starting point, we welcome the current formulation of sessions 15.1b and 16.1b and commend departments for taking these progressive steps, which are in keeping with international trends relating to child sexuality and sexual offences. We specifically endorse the submissions of the Community Law Centre, RAFCAN, the Women's Legal Centre, the Children's Institute and the Centre for Child Law, which you already heard last week and this week. And we echo the sentiment that the current formulation of the bill maintains protection for adolescents from sexual interactions with adults, as well as non-consensual interactions generally. That any sexual activity that is non-consenting, that is coercive, that involves some abuse of power, is addressed through the crimes of rape and sexual assault, and through the child protection provisions of the relevant child justice legislation, which, as Professor Skelton pointed out a few moments ago, could also potentially be augmented. In relation to the decision to prosecute, sections 15 sub 2 and 16 sub 2, although this is not in our written submission before you today, our first choice would have been, and initially was, to endorse the submissions of the Women's Legal Centre and the Community Law Centre, that this should rest solely with the National Director of Public Prosecution. Alternatively, as we do set out in submissions before you today, should power ultimately rest with the DPP, we requested a reversal of former formulation of this provision in that the DPP may not delegate this power, and further that an additional subsection 3 be inserted into section 67, being regulations, that will set out the measures that will be put in place specifically to limit the harm of exposure to the criminal justice system, and what those processes and procedures may look like. Further, alternatively, should the DPP ultimately be empowered to delegate his or her power, then we recommend the addition of further subsections 4 and 5 into section 67, again delineating the need for the minister to make regulations, detailing to whom decisions may be delegated, the factors that would need to be considered, and what measures, again, will be put in place to limit the harm of exposure to the criminal justice system. Moving on up to the National Register, and picking up discussions that were started this morning, specifically by Lorenzo Wakefield and Professor Skelton. In this regard, we are concerned the current bill seems to take a less measured approach, in that it no longer includes consideration of an assessment report by a registered mental health professional. While the current bill does obviously retain the opportunity for representation to be made for inclusion in the register, alternatively for the removal from the register, we believe that taking away the requirement for that formal assessment is regressive and also a regrettable step with significant consequences. And we accordingly submit that if a child is to be included in a register, alternatively removed from one, that the decision to do so must be informed by an expert in the field of child sexuality and child sexual offending at the expense of the state. In relation to representations more specifically, and picking up on what Lorenzo Wakefield was saying this morning in relation to fairness, we believe that although the current formulation of the provisions relating to representation appears to be neutral on the face of it, in practice, not only will it be unfair, but it will specifically amount to indirect discrimination on the basis of race and or ethnic or social origin, for the reason that Lorenzo mentioned, being that those with family means will be able to employ an expert, which report or opinion will be submitted to court, and those who can't will not. And accordingly, we endorse the provisions proposed by the Centre for Child Law in this regard, which formulation we also believe accord most with the Constitutional Court's judgment in terms of trying to balance less restrictive means with the best interests of society and justice. Notwithstanding all of that, however, the unit would like to reiterate our position that the registration of a child convicted of a sexual offence is not something that we believe to be in the best interest of children and really should only occur in extreme cases, cases that are considered after professional assessment to be a high-risk category case. We provide detailed, evidence-based and scientific reasons for this in our written submissions, which reasons were actually based on an expert opinion written for the Centre for Child Law by the Director of the Gender, Health and Justice Research Unit, Professor Lily Art, specifically to lead into evidence for the JHACE before the Constitutional Court. And if you would like a more detailed opinion to be made available to the committee, we can do so with pleasure. Briefly as possible, some of those reasons that were set out in that expert opinion include that research overwhelmingly demonstrates that sexual offences registers have little or no deterrent effect in the prevention of sexual offences, nor in reducing recidivism. That a lifetime registration of young offenders has been considered to amount to cruel and unusual punishment, specifically bearing in mind that punishment structures are intended to distinguish between adult and child offenders. And it's also been argued that registration requirements impose restrictions on young offenders that may inhibit their ability to embrace a reformed life, and also limit opportunities for becoming productive members of society later on. Also, specifically recalling that child justice systems have been universally created and are predicated specifically on the principles of restorative justice, rehabilitation and reintegration of young offenders, rather than punishment, the current formulation of the registration seems counterintuitive to these intentions. The sentiments that have been echoed by the Committee on the Rights of the Child in their general comments in relation to Article 4 of the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, in which they specifically echo those submissions. The current formulation also does not take into account the differences in the nature of and motivations for offending, factors that precipitate offending behavior among youth, neurobiological and social development, differences between children and adults, nor the rehabilitative potential of young offenders whose traits, according to research, are less fixed and therefore more open to rehabilitation than those of adult offenders. Social legal scholarship has also raised similar themes, such as the availability of the right to procedural safeguards to protect young offenders, and this would include informed judicial discretion, the consideration of specific circumstances, and assessment of risk. In relation to assessment of risk, proper assessment measures are required, and we started speaking about whether probation officers could potentially fill this role, and there's some concern about whether that would be appropriate or not. Where individual assessment for children is not part of the registration process or of registration maintenance about who should stay on, who should be removed, the risk and continued risk as a factor that is primary in this, in this consideration simply cannot be assessed. So for these reasons, we recommend that Section 50 excludes the order for registration of children under the age of 18 unless, as Professor Skelton said, out there are extremely compelling reasons for this, and that the child is considered to be an exceptionally high-risk offender, which determination needs to be made by a recognized expert in the area of child sexuality and child sex offending, that the onus of this should be on the state as well as the state's expense, and that where sexual offences are committed that are serious but do not fall within this exceptionally high-risk category, that those children, as part of their sentence, be sent into sexual offender rehabilitation processes. Lastly, almost done, we wish to echo and also raise again RAPCANs alerting this committee last week to National Adolescent Sexual and Reproductive Health Rights Framework Strategy, which has recently been finalised, insofar as it may provide guidance to government and to this committee on possible strategies for how best to address issues of adolescent sexual health and rights. And I wish to reiterate that this some 40-page document or strategy promotes a multi-sectoral approach, which seem to suggest an understanding and a concurrence that actually across government departments there is a sense that criminalization is not the appropriate response. And specifically it's the fact that the responsibility for implementation is a shared one. And specifically that shared, or more specifically, the shared responsibility, if sees as being, between government departments, specifically health, DSD, and the Department of Education, parents, families, caregivers, communities, schools, religious and traditional leaders, as well as civil society, faith-based and traditional leadership. As a last point, the strategy also is that tends to show itself as being in line with South Africa's international law obligations as well as existing legislation and policy. And one of the things that it specifically quotes here is that it is aligned to a statement in the population policy of South Africa that was written in 1998. So these things have been thought through for a long period of time. And specifically, that population policy refers to the refers to itself as being the promotion of responsible and healthy reproductive and sexual behavior among adolescents and the youth, specifically to reduce the incidence of high-risk teenage pregnancies, abortion, and sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV/AIDS, and this is the part that stood out, through the provision of life skills, sexuality and gender sensitivity education, user-friendly health services, and opportunities for engaging in social and community life. The strategy then specifically notes, in terms of the priorities, two priorities that are creating effective community support networks for adolescents and formulating evidence-based revisions of legislation, policy, strategy, and guidelines to do with adolescents' sexual health and rights. Something that I know this committee is deeply respectful of and engaged with, and that I hope will come up more in our discussions and whatever formulations of the ball follow from these hearings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take another presentation and then we'll go to the
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members. Thank you so much for this opportunity for me to be here today to discuss our concerns and ideas around adolescent sexuality and the law. I have a background in clinical psychology and research, specializing in prevention, development, prevention of violence, and promoting child and adolescent health. I'm currently a social scientist with the Gender and Health Research Unit within the Medical Research Council and at the Adolescent Health Research Unit at UCT, and technical advisor to the Sexual Violence Research Initiative and United Nations Development Programme. My work has a really strong focus on adolescent relationships, sexuality and well-being. I work directly with adolescents, with families and schools to do a lot of health promotion on these areas. So it's both direct engagement with these groups and also obviously engagement with the academic literature and data. So you've received the submission that I originally wrote together with Professor Alan Fisher for the Tedibay Clinic case, and I will go through some of it and be happy to answer questions later. So what we have found in the research setting is that becoming interested in experimenting with a range of sexual behavior during adolescence is what we would consider quote-unquote normal psychosexual development of people, or developmentally normative. And there's a range of sexual behavior that would be individual, but also engaging in different kinds of sexual behavior with a partner. We know also that adolescents' early sexual experiences have a significant impact on their future experiences and sexual and reproductive health outcomes, as well as a range of other health outcomes that we would be really interested in. But we also know that there are potential risks, especially for adolescents engaged in sexual behavior at younger ages. So the important thing is for us to focus on contributing to the overall positive development and specifically to healthy, safe, and respectful sexual behavior among adolescents. As all of the speakers have said before, this is not about encouraging or thinking that young adolescents should be engaging in any sexual behavior, but rather acknowledging that these kind of behaviors and curiosity around them are developmentally normative and that conditions should be in place to promote the healthy sexual development. So what we need to do is establish healthy, safe, and respectful norms, especially in a country where we have such incredibly high rates of sexual violence and sexual reproductive health outcomes. And we do that through comprehensive sexual reproductive health services and education that empower adolescents to make healthy and respectful choices themselves and to seek help and guidance without the fear of being charged with a crime or going through diversion. And when I say developmentally normative, I just want to make clear that when I'm saying that developmentally normative means that it is not unusual or necessarily unhealthy or harmful for adolescents to be interested in, to discuss or engage in a variety of sexual behaviors. It does not mean that everyone is doing it at the same time or the same way, or even that they should be. But it is something that we know, so we want to promote and support them to make healthy decisions. We know that adolescents or people reach physical sexual maturity sometime between the ages of 12 and 16. This is all based on local data available. And that they do engage in a variety of sexual behaviors. And this is regardless of the law or even rules that are enforced about open discussion. Certainly my research with teenagers has shown some parents who, with very good intentions, might try to forbid their children. You're not allowed to have a boyfriend or girlfriend, or you're not allowed to have sex, and feel that that will protect their children. Unfortunately, it does not. And we know that many teenagers will then go about it and find very creative ways to go and explore anyway. And so what we need to do is try and help them, when we're not with them, try and help them make better decisions. But we also know that sexual development is not only about the physiological development. It also has really strong and important psychological and social dimensions. Psychologically, people are adjusting to a new body and new feelings and thoughts about it, and also adjusting to how people view and react to their physical changes, and also a certain amount of curiosity. Socially, there's this relationships and peer relationships and new kinds of emotionally and physically intimate relationships are becoming quite interesting, and people are starting to experience feelings of sexual attraction. So we need to help adolescents manage that in open ways. Sexual exploration also may not only occur in dating relationships. We know that adolescents engage in sexual exploration with a variety of different people. It might just be casual friends and not necessarily dating partners. But we also know that dating relationships, especially at very young ages, are very fluid, very nebulous. Often it is more about being able to say that I have a boyfriend or girlfriend and not, in fact, that they're actually spending a whole lot of time together. They've told what the adolescents say to me, just want that person to send them a text or WhatsApp message now, I suppose. Good night. And that sort of emotional intimacy that certainly would pose less of a risk in terms of their sexual reproductive health anyway. We also know that there's high levels of peer influence and also gender construction of sexual experiences that are really important to consider, and all of those are outlined in the submission. And of course, all of the sexual development is being influenced by broader sociocultural norms and attitudes. We know that boys are more motivated by curiosity and girls more motivated by feelings of affection when they start engaging in sexual exploration, and that's certainly something to keep in mind when we want to promote healthy sexual behavior. But also we know that teenagers have a lot of conflicting emotions around sexuality. They're often feeling shy or embarrassed or awkward or uncomfortable, and this may mean that they want to avoid discussing it. And even teenagers who are having sex with other teenagers have said to me, we don't talk about it, we just do it. It's far too scary to do that. So there's also a level of excitement and interest. teenagers really love the sex ed part of life orientation, but you need to be able to do it in an open way. And in fact, research has shown that sexual communication that is open and comprehensive includes specific information and open discussion, including about risk and risk reduction strategies that you collaboratively make together with them, has shown to have a positive influence on sexual, on adolescent sexual behavior. When I say positive influence, I mean that they are less likely to engage in risk behavior, which I think is really important. So we do want to promote healthy sexual behavior, and I think that the criminal justice system and the law is not a way to do that. Who do we want to teach our teenagers about sex? Is it do we want to share our values with them and guide them to making healthy and responsible choices, or do we want their peers to be like, you know what, you should go and hang out with that older boy, or you should, we're going to go and teach that girl a lesson, or I'll show you how it's done, or the police, who, you know, would be in case of an arrest with this law. So the concern is that in the current situation, we would worry that it diminishes help-seeking by adolescents, it limits the ability to openly educate, empower, guide, and support adolescents. There could be a negative social impact, which we've already heard about this morning, and even just in terms of enduring stigma and shame, which is only going to reinforce making poor choices and decisions later on. So there is an overall increase of risk factors that is of great concern, and it's not going to help us in promoting healthy and safe and respectful behavior. And so I would just conclude and reiterate that really a law criminalizing consensual sexual behavior among young adolescents hasn't yet and is unlikely in the future to prevent teenagers from engaging in sexual activity and exploration. So I think what we want to do is focus on what do we need to do to promote healthy sexual development and decision making, and that's through effective programming, empowering families, empowering schools, empowering social development organizations to be able to do that, and we don't want the law to constrain or limit that. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for my opportunity to come there and see a member of the public. And I wrote in once I was approached by a few people with a petition to argue points that they wanted to challenge the bill. I would like to say that I'm a rape survivor. Okay, I was not forced violently into sex. If I was only 13 years old with an older man, and you are feeling for me, convinced me to having sex. I convinced myself for years that I had wanted act to take place. However, as I became a woman, I realized just how naive and impressionable I was. It was not feel right for that man to have sex with a child. I was not fully aware at that age what exactly he was wanting, and only once it was over, I realized something bad had happened. So I went into the situation thinking that, you know, this is going to be cool, fun. People talk about it at school, it's supposed to be, you know, an exciting experience. It wasn't all that. I was not able to make that proper informed decision, something I would have loved to have been able to do with my husband one day as a token of love, was taken from me because I was young and trusting. So in essence, this man, as you saw from my current husband, I'm married to, for 5 years. I did have a counselling for years to try and get my emotions right. Fortunately, this was free counselling provided by a local church. With the courts be willing to pay for counseling centres, and as I have heard people mention up here this morning that assessment and social workers, they are available to people that go through this kind of thing. To put up with all, to finally admit to being violated and go and talk to someone to collect and commit suicide, like you've seen the case of the girl that was violated in the Sunday paper by the two boys, I dealt with so much shame and guilt when in fact it was not my fault. I was too young and I didn't understand what was actually happening. I didn't really understand, and it's the truth of it. I was in denial of being raped for many, many years. And many case studies prove that many sexual abuse victims go into denial, and when the denial bubble finally pops, many women take their lives if they do not get the right help required. So if the child in point is not fully aware of what is really happening, it's a crime, especially when it comes to sex. The repercussions for sex can be forever life-changing. Contracting STDs, AIDS, like myself, end up with huge emotional psychological issues. So really from an older person, whether it be to have sex or do bad things I feel is wrong, because the adult should lead by example. Just like our government should set a great example. Case in point, look at women teach their children to steal. The children do not fully understand the repercussions of their behavior. In those instances, is a child the guilty party or the mother? I believe the child is to blame. Children do as they are taught and should not be abused or taken advantage of because of their disposition. It is not right and it's not fair. The culturally aged rampant, do you really think we should be giving the freedom to put the life of 12-year-olds at risk? And the laws may say yes, because they do not fully understand the repercussions of their decision. But in its view, she is not responsible enough to protect not only herself, but also any other man she sleeps with her from a disease like AIDS. Should she contract it from another man? Being involved, do you really think she understands how important protective sex is? She has no idea. Have you ever even seen someone suffering from AIDS? Or has she been watching the news? Probably not. She's only a child. There are laws that govern these things internationally as well. And what are we trying to achieve by allowing 12-year-olds to have sex? I know that the argument this morning has really been more about criminalizing children that are having sex with children. And in terms of what I feel on the matter is, if children are having sex with children, if the age gap this morning lasts like the lady from the University of Victoria was saying, then maybe they should reopen institutions like Boys Town or Girls Town, where those kids can go into rehabilitation facilities and get the right kind of perspective that they need on life. However, in my life example, what I've experienced is years and years of trauma. And it wasn't 5 years or 10 years, it's years of trauma. The violation, some people never get over it. You can talk to people that have been sexually abused at a young age, and some of them never ever come out of it. In fact, studies show that those women reach the age of 50, and they really do commit suicide. Sex, it's one of the worst, and from an experienced person, it's one of the worst things to have to cope with. I can thank God that I'm in a better space now, but it's taken me 20 years to get here. What happens to people that never get here? You know, they just never do. I'd like to also just mention that young girls, their bodies are not developed enough. If they do end up pregnant, their pelvic floors are not wide enough, and I'm sure doctors know this, that if they do give birth, they can die. So if they are impregnated, childbirth can become incredibly dangerous for them. Their bodies are not developed enough for this. So there's that, and then there's obviously AIDS and the rest, but everything else has been already mentioned the other day. I feel that instead of looking at it from, yes, I think like with my perpetrator, he should have been criminalized. I was not aware of the laws of this country. I was not educated. Again, reiterating what the lady Kimmy has just said, if I'd known that I could have had him, you know, or even then I was in denial of what happened, maybe realizing that someone's doing this to you, it's a crime. Maybe it wouldn't have happened. Maybe I would have said to you, are a criminal, stay away from me. But I didn't know that. And again, I would reiterate educating our children and maybe putting it into our school systems where we've got something the teacher says when people are trying to commit a crime like this. Understand you're looking at somebody who's prepared to go to jail if they're older. And again, when it comes to children experimenting, yes, you can't eliminate kids that want to experiment. They're going to be that group of 14-year-olds and 13-year-olds that want to touch and do things that they shouldn't do. But again, then those kids that are not seeing this as serious as I feel it is should go into centres or start therapy programs where they can start to deal with these things, because I feel they don't understand the real repercussions of what they do. I think there's a lot of not understanding. So I just came today to share that, and I know I'm not really a lawyer, doctor, or any of those things, but it's a real life experience that I wanted to share with all of you. Thank you very much for your time.
We must actually thank you for taking South Africans into confidence and give them your personal experience. But you know, we have the media who may quote you, and we don't want that to happen without your consent. Would you, Rika? Would you do? You wouldn't mind?
No.
Okay. And think that what all of us must be transparent. For that. Mrs. Vogel, are you here? Mrs. Vogel, are you here? Can you come?
I come from an organization which is victim-centered, Women and Men Against Child Abuse. We run on passion and, of course, funding, and we try to support victims as much as possible through court processes. I really would like to take the opportunity to acknowledge Community Law Center and the Center for Justice and Crime Prevention. We have endorsed their submission, and I'm going to try not to repeat anything that they have said, because we are fully behind what they have done, and we appreciate their work as well as the work and input from all the members of the Sugar Meter campaign. Without them, we would not have as much knowledge as we do, and we really appreciate the sharing of their expertise. Okay, we have kids clinics under the umbrella of Women and Men Against Child Abuse. We have clinics that provide free medical, psycho, and social services to children. Okay, we at Wamaka know and understand and are aware that our children, due to their natural human development, will show interest in sex, develop sexual feelings, establish intimate relationships, and have the desire to engage in sexual acts whether we like it or not, no matter what the consenting age is, and no matter what the law says. This bill does not lower the age of consent. It remains at 15 years old. And we at Wamaka know and understand that the more we talk about these issues and sex with adolescents and young children, the stronger our offensive against all forms of sexual abuse will be, which is what Wamaka is committed to. In 2011, we commissioned an in-depth qualitative investigation from Rachel Braylin's faculty, two very well-known academic researchers into teenage pregnancy, which we titled Young Mothers Seek for Themselves, Why We Became Pregnant. And exploring such terrain required access in the life worlds and perspectives of teenagers who've experienced conception, pregnancy and birth or abortion. And we learned a lot through the communication we did for that document. And one of the important messages we got from teenagers relevant to this discussion today was to parents and health officials that young people have sex without conception because they are afraid of their parents and they're afraid of approaching health professionals, which brings us to the current provisions of the Sexual Offences Act that we've all discussed this morning are a violation of children's rights as well as have not helped us in teaching children about healthy sexual choices. We at Wamaka believe that it is more important to restrict the predators and not the victims. The implementation of the rape laws must be strengthened, and any sexual activity that is non-consenting, coercive, or where there is abuse of power must be addressed through the crimes of rape and sexual assault and through the child protection provisions in the Children's Act. Study after study shows that teenagers want more information about sex than they are getting. When asked how they would choose to learn about sex, 9 out of 10 say from their parents. Yes, from their parents, not from their friends or a health class or books. When asked if they actually talk to their parents about sex, however, only about 1 in 10 say yes. The reason, according to most teenagers, is that their parents hold back and they are afraid to speak to us. Perhaps our generation feel awkward about discussing sex. We really don't know how to. We are likely come out of the age after the sexual revolution, but sex has still been a taboo subject in our homes. And when the time comes to talk to our children, we don't have the role models for being parents. Ideally, we believe that we should start talking to children before they become sexually active. The emphasis in school-based sex education, if it is being given, is usually on anatomy, physiology, basically the plumbing of sex. Sexual feelings and sexual relationships, the issue that concern adolescents most, are rarely mentioned. If contraception and STDs are introduced, it's often in the 11th or 12th grade, which may be after the fact. In short, sex education in school tends to be too little, too late, and if you do ask the children, very boring. We share the common call for support of parents, family, community, and comprehensive parenting programs to affect children's overall healthy development and sexual decision-making, to delay sexual debut, and to make decisions for which they are ready. Increased access to health and social services, youth development centers model an existing international model of this. And I repeat that. We really do believe that there's a huge need in the country for youth development centers. Because if we are in a situation where parents and communities are not taking care of their children, that's where we need to step in. And we do believe that there are successful youth development centers throughout the world that have high success rates in transforming children's lives. And especially when you look at the Northern European cities, what they've done to assimilate the refugee children that come to the country with all sorts of diverse programs, even with circus schools. You look at the Google Circus School in Sweden and see what that organization has done in getting children to be able to interact and lead normal lives. So our simple message is that consenting sexual behavior between adolescents should not be a crime. That it being a crime does a lot more harm than good, and that a more appropriate government response to ensuring healthy sexual decision-making by adolescents is to invest in programs for which there is evidence and they do work. As far as children being put on the sex offence register, we don't believe that this should be automatic. You've heard the arguments and we do support them. The only thing we added, I'm not sure, I think Molo Songolo probably raised this as well, that there should be a separate section to the child register for if there are going to be children on a register. I'm not sure anyone has raised that. Sorry, I only arrived this morning. Okay, they have. So they will raise it again, mainly because we just feel that if we look at what happens to the children that we support through court cases and the secondary trauma that they go through, we almost can't imagine what it must be like when a child is accused of a high-risk offense or possibly even what we're talking about today, consenting sexual activity that just should not be in the court at all. But what we would like to see, though, is that, you know, we already see a lack of services for child victims in court. So we need to get that right. But also, are we really going to be able to police a situation where children are not put on that register for the rest of their life? And if a child does get on that register, how are we going to make sure that their case is consistently monitored and that we ensure that they will come off that register if it's deemed that they should? And so let me conclude that we support the proposed amendments to criminalising consensual activities amongst adolescents. We do not support all provisions with regards to the placement of child offenders. We believe that these need to be reviewed, which we know that all the experts are going to do that. We should increase sex education, tighten legislation around paedophiles and use the unlawful federal assault or rape to prosecute child rapists. And it's best to start talking with children about sexuality openly in early childhood, and it's never too late. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you can come forward and sit here. I'm sure you will agree that in a few years' time, the children that you are talking about will be members of parliament. So it will be important that you give us all the submissions so that these children can see what you have been thinking and maybe be empowered to take better decisions than we may be taking now. So, honourable members, the floor is open. You could sit beside me.
on this thing seems to revolve around the consent of the young, consenting to. What is the age? Because I think the lady, which I really appreciate what you said, I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't do that. Thank you very much. You bring light. You are actually saying 13 is not consenting. And 14, maybe it's not consenting. What is the actual age? Because when you say between consenting children to the problem, what do you mean by consent? Because I think before a person can consent, must be fully being informed, not only of what he's doing, also about the consequences of what he's doing. And normally, well, maybe people will disagree with me, sex in my culture is to make children. Another one. People are changing it into making just be enjoying. And if that is the case, there can't be children who can consent to making children. And so on. When we talk about consent, what is the actual age? And what do we mean by consenting children? So that I would like to ask that part. Secondly, there is something which I want to be protected. Okay. So I would like just that question as to what is the for you and this thing of, and secondly, the second question, which may be directed to other people, would be that children are exposed differently to life generally, depending on the environment, as well as the parentage and so on. There are those who are told everything, and there are those who know nothing. How do you protect those who do not know from those that know? Thirdly, how do you, is it not hard to prove that science has agreed? How do you in court prove, you're a prosecutor, you have got to prove that science did not consent? Or friends or have consented. Because I think when it comes to the age of 12 and below, there is no that question coming down. Then is a 16-year-old and a 15-year-old and a 14-year-old. Now, consent, you have to go to court and go and pull consent. That is the problem. Can I get an answer? Thank you.
So that the question is addressed to all of you.
I feel many of the young teenage girls that I talk to, because I feel so strongly on the matter, I try to educate them about sex and about what happens if they do have sex and the repercussions of it, and they can fall pregnant. So I do what I can in my community, and I help other people with their daughters, and I try to make an impact in their area specifically. What I do find is the girls that are 14 are also not making conscientious decisions. They don't realize what they're doing. They're making the decision based on what Hollywood shows them on the TV, and it all looks like glitz and glamour. But the emotional aftermath, they're not able to cope with it. They are not coping with it. I'm phoning people like cancer to say to them, well, where can we take this girl? The one girl that I ended up with, she ended up with the social welfare, which they didn't even have a place for her. They could only take her to the hospital. So 14 is not even really girls are coping. 16 and up, possibly. I would maybe push it to 17 or 18, where they are coping, or they've got the emotional tools, but it's relevant to the person. If the girl's coming from an impoverished home, she hasn't got any emotional tools, she's already abused, you're looking at a different person to somebody who's coming from a loving home, where she's got lots of love, lots of self-affirmation, she feels good about herself, and she had a sexual experience at 17, and it didn't break her life completely. But yeah, very young, it's a crime, and if the person's older, they should be brought in front of the justice system, and they should be brought to task, as I feel, be it man or woman who does that to a young person. From the question on the ability to consent, the research on that I feel like does not give us very clear, and I want data. I want data on lots of teenagers, and I want to know what the population level trends are. What's the best thing for most teenagers? And unfortunately, we don't have the precise data to be able to answer that question absolutely. But for my clinical experience, I will say that people develop, and also the data show this, that people develop at different rates. What we need to do is we need to empower the teenagers to be able to make the healthy and the right choice and decision for them. And that includes issues around consent. And I would absolutely support the last speaker in the terms of comprehensive sex education is not only about the physiology of sex. It also has to be about the emotions. And one of the teenagers that I was working with, one of the big things she said is, why don't you tell us about how we'll feel afterwards? And boys and girls were both saying, they were just like, well, we had sex and we thought we wanted it, but I didn't know that I would feel like this afterwards. I didn't know that I would feel upset when he didn't smile at me when I looked at him the next day at school. Now, those things that they did not think about, because we have not empowered people with the ideas, what, let's really think about what this means. And we need to be able to do that. And certainly, I think this law is really focusing on consensual sexual activity. There is no question, I think, with anybody in this room, non-consensual sexual activity or sexual activity which age disparate partners, so very young teenagers with much older partners, is certainly not a question about something that we feel like we should step away from. No, we certainly do want the law to step in there. But at what age, I think that maybe the debate shouldn't necessarily be on what is the age of consent. I think what we are wanting to do is really to be able to promote healthy sexual development and healthy sexual decision making. And we do want to protect children who don't know, who maybe don't get that information at home. So this is partly about where schools come in, where civil society might come in, social services might come in, to be able to empower teenagers. And certainly that's some of the work that we are trialing at the moment in different parts of the country on being able to integrate that into, for example, life orientation curriculum, where it's meant to be. And there are so many ways to be able to do it in engaging and open ways. And that we know that it then helps children, we have the data on this, that it helps children to make better, less risky decisions. For example, delaying sexual debut. We don't want young teenagers to have sex, so how do we get them to make the choice to delay that? And part of that is the comprehensive sex education. In terms of proving consent, I mean, I think that maybe some of the legal experts in the room, Professor Felton potentially can talk more about the burden of proof, I certainly can't yet. But I do think what we do need to do is change the culture around consent, that active consent is really important. Consent should be freely given and excitedly given and active and not just something that's implied. And we need to certainly address those kinds of things. And it would be addressing certain sort of media stereotypes. And while we don't educate our children on comprehensive sex education, they are going to rely on things like the Hollywood movies, where maybe the idea around negotiating condom use or other contraceptives, negotiating whether you're going to have sex and what you're going to do sexually, is not done because this doesn't seem cool, it doesn't seem romantic. We need to change that. And the way to do it is, I think, not through the criminal justice system, but rather through the multiple avenues that I have noted. Thank you.
Just to what you were saying also about the age of consent. And for example, in Spain, the age of consent is 13, but the average age for a woman to have her first sexual contact is 19, and the average age for men is 18. So, you know, you can't put an actual figure on and say, if the age of consent is this, then all children are going to start having sex at this age. It doesn't work like that. And also the other thing I'd like to add, when you develop a sex education course, could you just add menopause to that, please?
It appears because of Hollywood and other influences, we
we have actually lost control of our children, and we solved something that we've never been able to solve. Because children want to experiment what they see in the screens, but we are not addressing those screens. We allow people to introduce all these kinds of things in our society. We don't prevent that. Now we complain about the consequences. Why is it that no one says we will do something about this Hollywood in our houses?
Can I say something? I also support SOP, which is Family Developer Post-Biography. I've got 4 teenagers at home. Okay, I've got 16-year-old, 14-year-old, and 2 5-year-olds. Okay, and we've got a blocker on our server, which means that there's no filter, it filters everything from the main server, who we get our imagery from. So be it YouTube or any of the other sites that they can go onto, they cannot access pornography in the house. I actually don't permit it, because you see it, you want to do it. What do you see monkey do, you know? And I've taken a very strong stance, because I don't want my kids damaged to the effect that I was damaged. So I am anti-pornography, and I think that when they have movies, we've got strict rules about what age they're allowed to watch. Can they watch if it's parental guidance, if it's 13, if it's 12? Even then, I don't even make my decision based on what it says at the back of the DVD. I make my decision based on what is the content inside that movie. If it's explicit and it says that it, even though it's 10, they're not watching it, because I know they're not ready for it. I think the way that our old grandparents did things, I think it was better. I think the way the world's become now, it's a lot worse. There's much more adultery, there's marriages that get broken down, there's a lot more devastation. Those things were there in place to protect everybody, and now everybody's just, you know, having a field day.
If I can just respond to this idea, the idea around because of Hollywood, I wonder, I don't think that we've lost control. We can still take some, and I don't think it's about control, I think we want to guide our teenagers. And there is the possibility to do that. And we cannot control everything that our teenagers are ever going to be exposed to, because we're not with them 24/7. We can't lock them up. And we don't want to, because that will harm them too. So please don't think that that's what I'm trying to say here. But we want people, if they're exposed to these things happen in the world. And I'm not saying that this means that you just open all your TVs and internet so they can look at porn. But if people aren't exposed to porn, there are ways, children specifically, there are ways to work around it. Well, this is an opportunity to have a discussion about the choices that some people are making. Or if this is out there, how are you going to deal with it when you are exposed to it? Because if they suddenly leave home when they're going to university, say, or when they move up for whatever reason, and their roommates are doing it, they're just like, oh, that looks fine, I've never been around that. That's also really problematic. And we know, so I think that completely trying to cut children off and pretend that something doesn't exist is really problematic and increases risk. And what we know from all of the data is that absence-only education is not only not effective, but it is harmful. And they've looked at us because in America, it's great peer control, and we don't want to repeat mistakes that they have made certainly. But absence-only education states where they've done that, they've had high rates of STI, higher rate of early sexual abuse, higher rates of teen pregnancy. The very things that we don't want our teenagers to experience, and also higher rates of violent relationships. That's not what we want for our teenagers. So an abstinence-only approach is really, really problematic. That's why an open and comprehensive approach is, it might seem scary, and we need to also think about how much of this is about our own anxiety and our own sort of wanting to control things versus doing what is in the best interest of children and adolescents, because that's our obligation here.
Thank you, Chair, and Ms. Morrison, thank you for coming and sharing with us. The dilemma we face with is the court has given an order in a very narrow issue relating to decriminalization. And I want to just mention to you, when you give your testimony of the age 13, had it have been a young boy of the age of 15, say, that committed the act with you, you would be charged for consensual sex. And I think that's the dilemma. You understand in terms, and I'm
so
sure.
So you're saying that had it kind of gone to court then, everything up to charge?
No, I'm saying in terms of the provisions prior to the bill, prior to the court as we drafted, what we're dealing with is consensual sex in that age of 12 to 16. You say you were 13, had it been, say, a 15-year-old boy that committed the consensual act with you, at the moment you would be charged as well. Are you aware of that? Because that is what that, and that clearly...
But that's ridiculous.
Exactly. Now, I think that's...
Sorry.
That's just...
That's ridiculous.
And I think many...
Because the boys are not as scared, I'll be honest. The girl's got to have something broken in there, her hymen's got to get broken. It's a lot more scary for the girls to say yes.
Yes.
It's a lot easier for the boys.
True.
And when they're done, they zip it up.
The point I want to illustrate from the African Christian Democratic Party is that many members from the Christian community don't understand the context of the court order. It's a very narrow court order. And many people have seen it as merely being the reduction of age of consent, but it's dealing with the decriminalisation issue, which is very important for us to all note. In your personal instance, you would have been protected, and you could have led a charge of statutory rape. But I think what it's if we appreciate that aspect, that's key, and that's why we having the NGOs are all here. It seems to why they're supporting the children in this aspect. You understand that consequence that is now being raised. But the point you illustrate very graphically is the dilemma of a 13-year-old being able to give consent. That's why Professor Skelton said that age is still 16. So, and the issue is coming out from other experts about teaching children.
Yes, now, obviously, the best way, yeah.
Abstinence is part of that, but a broader context, because we know, as I said in Parliament last week, the reality is that it is happening broadly in society. And the issue is how best to address that.
We talk about sex and our own freely.
No, that's exactly the point. You see, you're illustrating the family, the role of the family, number one. The role of faith-based organizations, the role of schools. The state should only come in as a last resort. And then the question is how. And that's where we've been saying, let's bring in social development. Let's bring in assessments and things like that. So I hope you have a broader understanding of the dilemma that we face with. And would speak to other faith-based organizations and say, this is the essence of the debate. You would have been charged. And clearly, we don't want to send children to jail for engaging in consensual sexual activities. Does that give you a better understanding?
Yeah, we don't want to do that. We want to send them into like a rehabilitation home or place of where they can get therapy on a continuous basis if there's already been trauma.
Or we want to help them.
More trauma, the doctor here says, it would be better to educate and maybe put it into our curriculums, you know, where they do, you know, we used to do RI in the mornings, maybe that can be, you know, once a week or whatever, to teach them, you know. This is all the tools you have to have sex with. This is what happens when you use them. You know?
Can I put a question also to Dr. Evers, or it's a broad. Yes. Absolutely, you should have studied law. Dr. Gevers, I appreciate your reports were very broad, and I don't unfairly just quote one aspect. But I think it is very important for us also to understand that the court did emphasize, and I'll read the paragraph where the court said, I accept that the purposes of discouraging adolescents, no one is encouraging adolescents to engage in sex, from prematurely engaging in consensual sexual conduct, which may harm their development, and from engaging in sexual conduct in a manner that increases the likelihood of risks associated with sexual conduct materializing, are legitimate and important. And there is a goal, when you speak about development to the normative, where you say it is not unusual or necessarily unhealthy and harmful for adolescents to engage in sexual behaviors. Now we know that's a broad range of things, right from kissing, hugging. But we're also talking about penetrative sex, homosexual and heterosexual. And surely you indicated when you started your discussion that there are risks involved. And so I just ask you to further clarify that statement when you say it is, clearly it is, you're correct, that's not unusual because it is happening in society. But is it correct to say it is necessarily unhealthy when we've given the high levels of HIV/AIDS, of teenage pregnancy, and I would tend to differ from that unless you speak it in a perfect society but I would think that there is a large degree of health risk involved in premature sexual engagement, particularly in the rural areas, in broader areas where you've got sibling-led households, you've got orphans, you've got high levels of HIV/AIDS.
Very good point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. As you said, that the statement is on acknowledging the variety of sexual behaviors that adolescents engage in, and to say that the variety is not necessarily you can't categorize that clearly into two camps. There's a lot of, it's on a continuum. And so if adolescents are able to freely consent and they happen to be mature enough to consent, given all of the non-physical ramifications of engaging in specific penetrative sex, which you've focused on. But if they're doing that, so there's that sort of psychological and emotional readiness, and they're engaging in sort of physically safe sex, they're using contraception, they're not going to become pregnant or get HIV or any other STIs. So we can't say that, and I also want to note the difference between developmentally normative and statistically normative. So there are certain behaviors that might be statistically normative, for example, the high levels of rape in the country. It might be statistically normative, but certainly not developmentally normative. It's not something that people naturally go through. That's what we're talking about, the developmentally normative. And so I think what we want to do is really focus on promoting adolescents engaging in healthy sexual decision-making, and certainly to delay sexual value, and sexual value really focuses on the first experience of penetrative sex. And so we certainly do want teenagers to delay it, but criminalizing it is not going to do that. So, yeah, do you have any?
Yeah, it was honorable chair. I think we just lost an opportunity because the presenters today were quite very decent about the issues that that are before the COVID. The opportunity that we have lost, I think, was to also bring those that were presenting last week to be to also hear some of the presentation, because they're very much educative. They too would have picked up one or two aspects on what exactly is before Parliament. And I would like to thank all the presenters. I think the matter is getting clearer and clearer. So my wish would have been they were all here to hear all our sides and the legal perspective of what is before us. But then we'll get another opportunity, I don't know. But another issue which is of concern is how we deal with this perception of what exactly is before us. Because what is before us is a simple matter of saying that we're not disputing the age of 60, that's a point of departure, that's a consenting age. But in the event, certain adolescents engage in this activity, is that not the crime? The same way we have dealt with adults. There was a time when adults was generally crime. And then courts ruled that, you know, let's just take it. The courts were not necessarily saying we're promoting it, but just saying it's no longer that part of a crime. So other issues that are social in nature or legal are issues that we must grapple with outside this decision of the court. Because we are now trapped into discussing, the issue of legalization when it's not the matter before us. And we are now, I see, we're paying less attention on one other critical matter, which the group on from just Center for Justice and Crime Prevention raised, the issue of the register. Who must get into the register? Who must give the consent? Because it's one matter that if we don't do it carefully, we're going to be caught up in a way in the future, because I have a view that even prosecutors, they see these things from their own angles. That those prosecutors that are purely Christians and they see things differently. There are those that are from the other religions. So if you just take that matter and put it to those prosecutors, we are likely to get a different response. So those are the issues I think that in the main, because the rest of the legislating now, the issues that the register, centralizing it, making sure that the person who deals with it is just the person who is an objective test in determining what must happen. Otherwise, these other issues, these many issues of the social nature, issues that we will have to have some dialogue in the future with other departments and deal with the, and deal with those issues, because what the sister they raised, that at her home, in the server that blocks and so on, but the appreciation that must be there is that children are not only staying at home, they're staying with friends, they have WhatsApp, they have all sorts of things that they see. So then it borders around the issue of the role of parenting, the role of civil society organizations, the role of the churches and so on. Because the discussions we had last week, they really confused my mind in terms of what exactly should we do. But when I'm coming today, I can see how we must separate and package these issues. So it is very important that they also learn from what they were learning from the presentation. Thank you.
I think you are raising that because you see, sometimes presenters appear before us and they take what they tell us as the gospel truth. Then they go outside and preach that gospel. But by listening to other gospels, then we can get a common ground. So you can see that you have helped us. Some of us are already indoctrinated from last week. So thank you very much. Honorable Hon, you will follow. Honorable Hon.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is to Dr. Gibbers. She mentioned that physical maturity amongst adolescents is attained typically between 12 and 16 years old. And then she admitted that there is no sufficient data to ascertain with accuracy what age adolescents are able to form consent. So my question is, given the fact that we're working with the 12 to 16 year old bracket, and the fact that there is physical maturity, is there any indication that some 12 years old, or at least, and if possible in your experience, what percentage of 12 year olds are able to form consent, or are we, in terms of dealing with them from 12 year olds, only taking into account physical maturity?
I think that the age of consent issue, because consent is not only about a physical ability, because there are all these other psychological, emotional, and social aspects to it. And that is why it is so difficult to pin down. And so I think, and I can't give you a percentage, but I've certainly cut across in my clinical work, and also now that I'm doing research around the country and in various countries around the world, that teenagers develop at vastly different rates. And so we can't say how many percentages of 12-year-olds are able to consent, are they able to fully appreciate all of the consequences. I'm not even sure that adults can always consent. So do they fully appreciate all of the consequences when you're agreeing to something with some, you know, some activity with someone, even if it's not sex, I mean, even if it's a business interaction, you know, you think you've covered everything, you think you know what's going to happen, but you don't, and you learn from those experiences. So I think that it is really about equipping people as best we can to be able to think through what the various consequences are and whether or not they want to consent, and the idea that, you know what, you do have a choice about what happens to you. It's not that, oh, you have to, because that's what women do. You have to reach this, you have to go along with it, or you have to convince the girls to have sex with you in any way that you want. I think that we really need to address that, and it is empowering to say that you have the choice to decide what happens to you and to your body, and to have that in a participating way. I mean, child participation is one of the values of the country, and so I think we do want to include that in this issue as well. And so that people are making healthy choices from an early age, and that will really be helpful through the long term. Can I respond to another thing that was raised? Yeah, thank you. It's just a couple of people have raised this issue around the concern on public perception. I certainly do appreciate that concern. But I think that, I mean, first of all, there are multiple organisations, I'm sure, and certainly multiple ones in the room, who we all do work on this issue. And I certainly, all of the family and educator and the sort of school-based work that we do, we start, you know, people just like, what are you trying to bring to us? And through the process of dialogue, are able to open the conversation. So people do know how to help, if you are concerned about that, how to manage the public perception, educate them. And I actually think that we should look at this as a gift and an amazing opportunity for us to change the landscape of sexuality in South Africa, because we've got such high levels of sexual violence. And how many adults do we know that are making poor or unhealthy or unsafe sexual choices? So this is not only about educating the children and adolescents to do that, but also maybe about educating some adults, and so that if those adults are making better choices, those are better role models, which we know are such significant influences in adolescents' decision-making. That's absolutely key. So I think we should really see this as an opportunity to improve the sexual reproductive health of the country. As we deal with the sort of managing the public perception and educating the public on what the changes in this law mean, but also what they, you know, how now does this mean that we're going to promote positive and healthy sexual decision making and sexual development. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would just like to respond to Honourable Bunga's assertion around prosecutors and the decision that they would might want to apply to have children placed on the register or not. And I do feel from the first point we should appreciate and respect the independence of the prosecuting authority. I think that in the past, and Professor Skelton had mentioned this in her presentation, that advocate, that prosecutors are essentially very independent and do what they should be. On the other side also, I think that there's a lot that could be coached within directives to the Act, and this is being done in the Sexual Offences Act, the previous Act, and those guidelines coming from the prosecuting authority on what are those factors to take into account before you actually go and apply to have a child placed on the register. And Professor Skelton also mentioned, though, is it a violent offence, is it a history of violence? In the case of Jay, for example, where it was, I think it was two boys and one girl that he has raped. Those are all indicators to take into account on sending the child for an assessment by a suitable person, and that person's findings essentially should hold some form of weight within the court. So just to say that there are ways in which we can coach that protection to make sure that the decision is taken from an objective position as opposed to being influenced by various other external factors. Thank you very much.
Independence of the
in the sense that the prosecutors would be doing what they are mandated to do, and they would not take external factors into account, such as their own personal religion or their own traditional background or any other factor for that matter, but what they are said to do set out in the law and in legislation.
Yes, I just want to follow up on that, in our proposed solution we would have the prosecutor simply giving notice that this is the case where I'm going to ask for a child to put on the register. And if it goes as we imagine, the prosecution would ask for more, that to happen in more cases than it actually eventually will turn out to be. Because the final decision will rest with the court. So the prosecutor will say, I want to put this child on the register, there'll be an assessment, the lawyer for the child will come forward and say, I'm trying to argue against the child going on a register, and then finally the court taking all of the arguments and the assessment report into consideration makes the final decision. So it does take, it doesn't mean the prosecutor has discretion, only that they are the ones that indicate that this is the case where they're going to go for putting the child on the register.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to welcome the presentations and to say that it has been
a really interesting journey to listen to their presenters and to think of their presenters and their line of thinking in terms of what needs to be done. But of course, I also want to reiterate the fact that public perception is very important. So it's very important that the message out there is quite clear of what the committee has to do. Because what we're grappling with is already the public listening, that now the committee has got to come up with a law that actually gives permission to children to have sex, which is not the case. And as long as that is clear, and it will actually make the whole process to be easy in terms of looking and looking at what needs to be done and doing all the submissions, taking into consideration the order of the court, because we're just responding to the order of the court. It's just that you're dealing with something that is sensitive, that is quite challenging, but we live with it as human beings, the thing called sex, and how we perceive and see sex, and how children get introduced to it. All that is challenging, but it has been very interesting to listen to the diverse views that will actually help us as a committee. And we conclude the matter. Thank you.
We requested the parliamentary media last week to arrange interviews for different members of parliament in the different languages. I hope they will continue to do that now. And also the presenters, you are free to continue, write articles, debate, try to involve as many people as possible in these issues. Tomorrow I will be on Morning Live, so don't take what I say seriously. I'm really just going to reflect on the debate. So what I say is not the position of Parliament, because the position of Parliament will emerge from all your contributions. So we're not going to impose anything on you, because you are the people. We want the law to reflect the will of the people that will represent. The Department of Justice are here. They are listening carefully. So we will all be covered. So is there still anything that people want to say?
I'm not there for. Thank you very much for enriching the debate and also for empowering Parliament. I think we're clearer now than we were ever before. We'll never reach a stage when we can do the research that you do, so you are a valuable resource to us. And we appreciate everything, and thank you very much. Okay. Let me choose again.